Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Jones! Bowden! He's got it! England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins!
Stokes flashes away!
Well, sorry, Simon. I had to do that. I had to interrupt our normal theme tune to play a bit of funereal music. It's a funereal day if you're an England fan after seeing that schmozzle of a batting performance by England. 147 all out. The only good thing about 147 is the perfect break, isn't it, in snooker? But it's not really a very good cricket score. So how did you see it?
Well, I saw it as England winning the toss and batting first on a green pitch and an overcast day. And Rory Burns out first ball to Mitchell Starc. Dramatic start to the Ashes series. Starc pumped up and it just went on from there. It set the tone for the day. England lost wickets consistently. They got to lunch four down, but then they lost another wicket straight after lunch when Hamid was out. There was a bit of a recovery. Pope and Butler put together a 50 stand, but then both got out in quick succession and the rest fell like a pack of cards. And it was Pat Cummins' day. First day as Australia's captain. Picks up his first ever Ashes 5 for, easy this captaincy lark, isn't it? 5 for 38 and Australia in firm control, very firm control after the first day. And you feel already that they're in a winning position in this game.
Obviously then the heavens opened and no chance of play afterwards, which I guess, you know, when you have been bowled out for 147, I think in actual fact, in some ways, maybe it's a good thing that England didn't come out again afterwards, because although you've been riled by that terrible batting performance as a bowling attack and you want to come out and make amends, at the same time, firstly, there is that sort of demoralisation sort of setting in and that can affect how you bowl. Secondly, obviously, Australia would come out buoyant having bowled England out for 147. And I think thirdly, a bit of dampness around in the outfield could affect the ball as well. So in many ways, perhaps it was a blessing in disguise that England didn't get the chance to bowl and they can, you know, sit overnight and consider everything, come out tomorrow feeling, you know, better about themselves. A new day, a clean slate, if you like. There's that old thing about you never know how a pitch is until both sides have batted on it, though. I don't know. It didn't look that bad. I mean, it did a bit, didn't it? And they bowled superbly, but it's not 147 all-out wicket, definitely.
I think that's absolutely right. That, you know, it did do a bit, but I think what was there in that first session, and it to me it just felt like a step too far against that bowling attack in those conditions, green pitch, overcast. So to me, it seemed more logical to bowl first. It's not easy either way. You know, you put yourself under pressure, don't you? You strive to take wickets, and of course the side that England picked, you know, they sort of set themselves up to bat first in a way, haven't they, by including the spinner, leaving out Stuart Broad, who you feel might have bowled quite well in those conditions this morning. They left him out, so they sort of felt a bit committed to batting. And, you know, to be fair, Australia said they would have batted first. And also, at Brisbane, every side has batted first since 2008. Mind you, they've not always won the game. I think there were 6 defeats in there as well for the teams that have won the toss and batted first. So it doesn't, you know, guarantee anything. It just felt, I mean, from a distance, it felt like a bowl first morning. But both captains said they wanted to bat first, and you know, in a way Joe Root was the unlucky one. He won the toss. It might be one of those days, you know, when it was a good toss to lose.
It was definitely a good toss to lose. It's a horrible thing to say, it's a cliche, isn't it, good toss to lose, but the thing is, if you win the toss, you've got to make a decision, and that decision comes back to bite you if you don't play well. And obviously it has in this case for Joe Root. I think that obviously, history plays a part in this, and you know, the famous Nasser Hussain put them in Brisbane in 2001 when Australia went on to get nearly 500. And there have been other instances of that as well. But of course, think about it recently, that last Test match played at the Gabba against India, where they chased 320 odd to win on the last day. So I was going to say that, you know, when you come to a ground, you have to sort of factor in, would I rather bat first or would I rather bat last? Which is going to be harder, batting first in the match or last in the match? Will the pitch deteriorate significantly? And I think in the past, Gabba pitches probably have been better to bat on early in the game, even though there might be a bit of life in the pitch for the first couple of hours, than late in the game where spinners and uneven bounce can come into play. But maybe more recently, where I think generally pitch preparation has got more sophisticated, pitches don't deteriorate as much as they used to, and therefore actually batting last isn't so bad. So, you know, you have to factor all this in, but in the end, I guess you have to think, well, how much is that pitch going to do? If we get through the first hour and a half, 2 hours, will it flatten out and play easier? And that was what was obviously in Joe Root's mind. I don't think it's going to happen because it looks as if it's going to have something in it for 2 or 3 days, especially with the weather.
Yeah, I think one of the points is, you know, is England's top order good enough to resist Australia's attack in those conditions, i.e. green pitch and overcast conditions where the ball is just doing enough? I have to say, I was really impressed with Australia's bowling. And you can talk about England's batting all you like, and you know, it always comes back to that comment that Jeffrey makes, isn't it, about Test cricket. You have to learn to keep the good balls out. That's how you survive and thrive in Test cricket. You're going to get good balls. You have to keep them out. That's the way you're going to make runs, because you are going to get them. And England were just not able to do that. And there was some really good bowling. So I mean, there were some one or two iffy dismissals, but I think the majority of the top order were dismissed by good balls. You know, in the channel, in the corridor, just doing a bit, bouncing a bit, whatever. And you know, they were got out. So in that sense, it wasn't like an abject England performance. It wasn't like swishing and driving and cutting and nicking off like that. You know, they were got out. So, you know, I think you have to say fair play to Australia for that. And, you know, Hazelwood was excellent. I mean, I think perhaps the one exception, you know, right at the start of the day, and if we talk about our sort of most significant moment of the day, or the play of the day, if you like, I think that came right at the start. The first ball, there's always a big focus on the first ball of an Ashes series, and you know, there have been some significant ones in the past. You know, I remember Michael Slater cutting Phil de Freitas for four, first ball in Ashes series. We all remember Steve Harmison bowling that huge wide, and today we had something similar. We had Mitchell Starc castling Rory Burns. But I mean, you sent me a photograph during the day's play, a still of where Rory Burns' right foot was. And, you know, he was in no position really to play that delivery. His foot, rather than sort of going perhaps down the pitch or even slightly open, it was right across outside off stump. It was, you know, it's a terrible position to play that delivery. I mean, you can analyse it a bit more. I mean, you've played the game, but to me, it just looked horrendous.
Yeah, I mean, he has got a funny method. We all know that. And he does, there's a lot of moving parts to his stance and trigger movements and so on. But I think that was accentuated, even exacerbated, by the tension, the enormity of the occasion, the first Ashes test in Brisbane, the national anthems. You know, all that kind of just feeds into your body, and your body's movements are a little bit more exaggerated perhaps than they might be normally. But that position was extraordinary, where his right leg, his front leg, was well outside off stump and the ball was outside leg stump. So it was almost a cross-legged approach to try and play, and such a contrast to modern methods, which is clearing your front leg, keeping your front leg out of the way and allowing your bat to get to the ball, which is a product largely of white ball cricket. But even in red ball, you know, batsmen are more intent, especially with DRS, to keep their front leg out of the way to allow the bat to get to the ball. So it is a strange method. I think, as I say, it was sort of exaggerated by the enormity of the occasion, where you do everything a bit more probably exaggerated than you would normally. And he was in an even more strange position than normal. It wasn't a deliberate ball, by the way. A lot of people thinking that Mitchell Starc would have got known about Rory Burns getting across his stumps and therefore going for a leg stump, ball into the leg stump. I don't think you would ever start a bowling spell, certainly in a test match at the beginning, thinking I'm going to try and bowl a leg stump half volley because it's the one ball that all batsmen want. I think Starc is always someone who looks to try and bowl full, looks to try and bowl off stump, but he just got his line a tiny bit wrong. And it did actually swing back from outside the leg stump to just hit the leg stump. So it did swing a bit, which I suppose means that Burns was slightly unlucky, but he was in such a horrible position, he had no chance of really getting his back to the ball. And it was just it was so shockingly bad. It was such a shockingly bad start. You kind of didn't know where to look. I mean, for him, for Burns, it must have been just the your worst nightmare. You've got all those thoughts in your mind building up to the Ashes, your first experience of the Ashes in Australia, and all the kind of eulogies that have been spoken about you in the team, and you've watched video highlights of your best innings and all that sort of stuff, and you're kind of dreaming the night before, lying awake, and then dreaming the night before of making 100 in your first Ashes appearance in Australia, and it's all over in one ball. I mean, it just must be the most cruel thing imaginable.
Yeah, I suppose the game gives and the game takes away, doesn't it? Rory Burns' first test of the last Ashes series, he made 100 against Australia at Edgbaston. I know England went on to lose the game. I mean, he had quite a lot of luck, didn't he? A lot of flirtation outside the off stump, but he made 100. Fantastic moment for him. This time, first innings of an Ashes series, out first ball, and you have to walk off. And the other thing as well, I suppose, the problem for Rory Burns is that that sort of clip of him being bowled is going to be played over and over again, because it's, when we think back on Ashes series, it's going to, that Steve Harmison ball is played over and over again. To be fair, the Michael Slater cut for four off Phil de Freitas in the 94-5 series isn't played over and over again. I suppose it depends who has the rights to it. But, they do feel big moments, don't they, at the start of an Ashes series. And it seemed to sort of define the day, really. Mm. It's funny how that, can happen. In a way, it shouldn't or doesn't have to.
It's so deflated. It's so deflating for your team to see that.
Yeah.
But on the positive side, if you think back to 2010-11, Strauss was out of the fourth ball. Yeah. I mean, that build up that England had as well was tremendous. Four warm up games, a camp in Germany beforehand, and the team all in excellent form. I remember Ian Bell got 192 in a warm up game and took Steve Smith, who was then a leg spinner, largely apart, and England was such, so positive coming into grab a test. And then the fourth ball of the match, fourth ball of the series, Andrew Strauss pokes one to gully. And I remember him saying, actually, that after that first day, where I think four of them were out for naught, certainly Strauss and Stuart Broad and Matt Prior all made ducks, and they all sat next to each other in the changing rooms, and they were sort of looking at each other at the end of the day, saying, God, all that expectation and build-up, and here we are, three of us haven't got a run between us. And that was a bit the same for England today, wasn't it, with Root and Robinson also out for naught.
Yeah, and Stephen Finn was talking about that match, actually, on Test Match Special today. And he was saying that they knew they'd underachieved. They got about 260 in their first innings. They knew they'd underachieved. I'm sure England will have that feeling tonight. 147, it's nothing, is it, really? You don't win many Test matches with 147. You need an excellent bowling performance to drag it back. And Australia got a 221-run first innings lead. And Finney was saying, but then we had something magical. And it feels like that already, that England are going to need something really special to get themselves back in this match. You can see Australia getting a big enough first innings lead to squeeze the pressure on them in the second innings. And that's sort of projecting ahead a bit. And we are actually going to project ahead towards the end of this podcast, because we're going to predict the score for the second day, as we're going to do throughout this test series. We're going to try and look ahead and tell you what we think the score is going to be at the end of the next day's play, and the closest will take the predict the score trophy at the end of the Ashes series.
Well, it might not be feeling like a beer right now, but Beer 52 is a craft beer supplier like no other, sending experts all around the world to find the best beer available anywhere on this planet. And in true Christmas spirit, Beer 52 are offering listeners of this podcast 10 free beers. All you have to do is go to www.beer52.com/cricket and cover £5.95 for postage to claim your free case. Each month, Beer 52 members receive a new case, usually from a different part of the world. Members have had beers from more than 40 countries across 5 continents. If dark beer is not your thing, stout or whatever, simply choose the light option instead of a mixed case. And as well as the delicious beer, you'll receive Ferment magazine, which delves into the beers, breweries and themes of beer making around the world. And you'll also get 2 delicious snacks to wash down with the beer. So Your appetite and thirst is quenched all in one go, and it might just take your mind off the cricket. Go to beer52.com/cricket, and after claiming your free case, you'll join the monthly beer club, which is £24 a month. No minimum commitment. Pause or cancel any time.
We should say something about Pat Cummings, but also, you know, this idea of Cummins to Root, captain to captain. But actually, it was Hazelwood that got Root today, and that's the eighth time that Josh Hazelwood has got Root in this series. So there's this talk about this head-to-head between the two skippers, but it's Josh Hazelwood, and you know, we had others on the Virtual Cricket Club the other day talking about, you know, up against McGrath, that, you know, McGrath, you know, did have his number. He just admitted it. He did have his number. He got him out 19 times. Hazelwood's got Root out 8 times now in Test cricket. And, a decent delivery early on and Root out for naught.
Well, look, the key is, with any series against Australia in Australia, the key is to survive the new ball, because the first 12, say 15 overs, the ball definitely does something. And after that, it does get a bit easier. And if you look at England today, they lost 4 wickets before 15 overs were bowled. So obviously, Rory Byrne's gone to the first ball. Milan, I thought, could have left his. I mean, it was a pretty good ball from Hazelwood. It bounced and moved away or angled across him. But you've got to look to leave those back of the length balls early on. And you know, they're going to bounce over the stump. So you don't need to play those, really.
That's my point, Jos, that's my point about, you know, not getting out to goodish balls in Test cricket. Do you know what I mean? And I felt that with Milan, actually. It was a decent enough ball, wasn't it? It bounced a bit, as you say, angled across him. But those are the balls you need to survive, to thrive, I think.
Definitely. And, you know, a bit of a tame dismissal, really. I thought Root's ball was pretty good. You could say, could he have left it? No. Could he have got a little bit further forward? Marginally, maybe. But it just was a perfect line and length and moved away enough and took the edge. Sometimes all you have to hold your hand up and say, I don't know what else I could have done there. Hope the edge doesn't carry, perhaps, you know, is the best that Root could have hoped for. But, you know, because he was exposed to that new ball, it did make him more vulnerable. And that may be one of the reasons why Hazelwood has taken his wicket so many times, because Root's had to come in so early when the ball is still hard and new. And then Stokes, I mean, probably a bit unlucky. That was a good ball from Cummins, a typical aggressive length, just short of a length, but kind of angling in from outside from round the wicket. So sort of as if it was difficult for Stokes to leave it because of the angle. You do get drawn into playing it, even though it was short of a length. And then it just probably held its line slightly, maybe moved a touch away and sort of squared him up and a good catch at third slip. So, you know, suddenly England are 4 down in 12 overs, and it's just so difficult to come back from that. In fact, to their credit, they did come back from that, actually, because after we could talk about Hazib Hamid in a minute, but, you know, that counter-attack from Pope and Butler was excellent.
It was, yeah. It just got snuffed out too early as far as England are concerned. I mean, it was 112 for 5. The recovery was on, and then Stark got one. Again, you know, that sort of good line just across him and nicked him off. And it, you know, perhaps a typical Gabba dismissal, Australian tall, fast bowler dismissal at the Gabba. And that's what Australia can do. I mean, they have got 3 quality pace bowlers in Stark, Hazelwood and Cummins. And they didn't have a great deal of red ball bowling going into the Ashes, but they made it work today. There was so little there on offer for England. I thought that was the interesting thing, is they were so disciplined, as they were last time in 2019.
Yeah, they were. I agree. I mean, I think Hazelwood is a better bowler than Glenn McGrath. Obviously, he hasn't had that longevity.
Wow.
I know that's a big call.
Wow, Yoz.
I think that he's got more ability. He moves the ball more. McGrath basically bowled. I mean, the difficulty with McGrath was 2 things. Firstly, he bowled with his left foot almost on the leg stump at the non-striker's end. So he was right over the top of the wicket to wicket. And he just had that relentless line of length. And he was able to generate more pace and bounce than you'd expect, because he had such a high action and a very good wrist release. But he didn't actually, and this is almost in the days before things like wobble seam and, you know, cross seam and all that, he didn't really move the ball. In fact, often, if the ball did swing, he didn't bowl nearly as well. He was just a very good line bowler, which is why he was so good at Lord's, for instance, using the slope to brilliant effect. Hazelwood has a similar ability to keep control and bowl, you know, relentless line and length, but he can move the ball either way as well. And I think he's a bit quicker than McGrath. So, you know, I think all in all, he is probably a better package. Obviously, the thing about McGrath is he was a batsman hater for 15 years and he managed to maintain that amazing fitness record and relentless line. And he was a metronome and he got 560-odd test wickets, which is an amazing achievement. But Hazelwood, if he stays fit, he'll get into that area.
Well, Glenn McGrath took 563 test wickets, an average of 21.64. And Josh Hazelwood has taken, well, before this test match, 212 wickets at 25.95. This was his 56th test match. And Glenn played, let me have a look. Glenn played 124 tests. So he's got a bit to do. Josh Hazelwood. It was a big call, yours, anyway. Well,
I just think from a kind of purely from an athlete's and bowling skills point of view, Hazelwood has more going for him. But obviously McGrath was peerless until Anderson overtook him.
So, yours, England 147 all out, a rain curtailed first day. Any way back for England in this test match? I mean, there was a lot of rain around. It does dry quickly at the Gabba. I mean, normally you need a lot of rain around. You think it still might be tricky to bat tomorrow. What do we think?
I don't think any way back, personally. I think that, you know, Australia will get a decent lead. What they may learn from it is that, you know, if you're positive, even in difficult conditions, you can turn the table. So while Hazeeb Hameed was dedicated and disciplined in his defence, you know, you can always keep him in, because eventually, you know, there's going to be a ball with his number on it and he's going to get out, which is exactly what happened. Whereas, and bowlers can just plug away and eventually they'll get him out. Whereas with Butler and Pope, you could see as soon as they got together, and not only Butler's brilliant skill and wonderful timing and positive intent, but also Pope, really busy running between the wickets, looking to score all the time. It puts bowlers off. They don't bowl as well. So, you know, as soon as Butler hit Hazelwood back over his head a couple of times, they had to change the field. Hazelwood dropped his length back slightly. And that was one thing that I thought was outstanding about Australia today, is they bowled a foolish length. You can get onto those sort of pitches and see the ball move and bounce and bowl a bit too short, and batsmen play and miss and it looks great, but it doesn't take wickets. They bowled a fuller length, and that's what got most of the wickets for them. And Butler and Pope sort of made them change that and forced Hazelwood to put a long off and drag his length back a little bit. And they had to change the bowling, and they had to bring Lyon on, and they had to bring Stark on. And, you know, it just made Australia think. And, all right, it didn't last that long, but it was a message. It was the same message, of course, that, do you remember in 2005, that first Ashes test at Lord's, where England bowled Australia out for about 190 and everyone thought, well, here we go. And then obviously Australia bowled England out for less. But Peterson made a statement in that first innings. He took McGrath on and hit him back over his head and hit Warne into the stand, the grandstand. And that immediately sent a message to England, right, we've got to be more positive. And in the next test they were. So, you know, even though it's an obvious thing to say, I thought that Butler and Pope's approach was the right one for England, and they have to sort of adopt that as a team, I think, and be more positive. Today, they were just hit by this, you know, onslaught of superb bowlers and movement, and, you know, they look a bit stunned, but on reflection, there are some messages there that they can take on and be positive about.
Yeah, so let's look ahead. England's attack has got to limit Australia's first innings score clearly. What we haven't talked about actually is just the makeup of that England attack. We were trying to work out who would play in the lead up to the game. We talked about the possibility of five seamers, talked about the possibility of them playing a spinner. They went for the spinner, but no Stuart Broad. Jimmy Anderson not playing as well. No Stuart Broad for England. Are you surprised by that, the fact they left Broad out?
I'm really annoyed because I wrote a massive piece for the Sunday Times previewing the series, and it was all about Warner v Broad, and Broad would be my third name on the team sheet after Root and Stokes, and he wasn't even in the team. I mean, I thought that was astounding. And obviously, the guys there on the spot know how Broad is bowling, how he's feeling. But I didn't get the sense from just looking at the pictures that he was a guy who was relieved not to be playing. I think he was a guy who was desperate to play. And we know with Broad, you don't leave him out at first tests because he proves you very, very wrong very quickly. And yeah, I just think that the psychological hold and technical hold he has over Warner in particular, and of the Australians generally. I mean, he's got a great record in the Ashes overall, over 100 wickets in the Ashes, under 30. They respect him. He took 5 for here. Do you remember that time when they wouldn't name him?
Yeah, 6 for 81.
Because he hadn't walked in. He hadn't walked at Trent Bridge the year before, and so they refused to name him Stuart Broad. They called him the medium pacer from Nottinghamshire or something. And he took 5 for, didn't he, at the Gabba, and kind of defied all their pre-match kind of Mickey taking. So I thought it was a big mistake, that personally.
Yeah, well, obviously it created a lot of talking points. No Anderson, no Broad, and that's happened so rarely for England. But time does move on. Anderson's 39 and Broad is 35, and Broad hasn't bowled in a first class match since the 7th of August. So there's that aspect to it as well. But yeah, it did seem like a very big call from England, and it just sort of feels as though some of the calls they've made already just haven't worked out for them. So they need something to try. They need something tomorrow to try to reverse that, to sort of push the game back, or at least take some of the game back towards them. So then, Yoz, second day's play. We're going to do our predict the score. What is the score going to be at the end of the day's play? Now, we're not just going to do a random number. We've actually written our scores down, so we don't sort of cheat here. We've written our scores down. I've got mine. What's yours? You can go first tonight. What have you written down?
Well, because it's not quite certain how much play there'll be, because I know there's sort of showers forecast. So I'm assuming not a full day's play, and I'm saying Australia 190 for 4.
Oh, my goodness me. Oh, my goodness me. That's incredible. I've written down 189 for 4. Well, that is remarkable. There's been no collusion or anything like that. We're thinking in a very similar fashion. So anything above 190 tomorrow, you 90. Win, and anything sort of 189 below, I win, I suppose. Well, it depends.
And what happens if we're both horribly wrong? Is that the end of our attempts to predict anything?
Well, I think that's just a draw, isn't it? On the day, the draw. We'll have to have half a mark each on that. Okay, so let's see what happens tomorrow. You've got 190 before. I say 189 before. Same reason, the weather. We'll see how it turns out. Play starting half an hour earlier to try to make up for some of the time lost today. England need wickets. Australia looking to build a first innings lead and then squeeze England in that second innings. That's our wrap-up of this first day of the Ashes series, a really deflating one for England. Hope you've enjoyed this roundup. We'll be back with more tomorrow. Thanks very much and goodbye. Sports Social Podcast Network.